The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So it's very nice that you could come to this ceremony in particular, the birth of the Buddha. As it says in the offertory that was recited at the end of the ceremony, the birth of the Buddha brought the Sun of Hope to a world of darkness and illuminated the whole universe. This is very important for us to keep in mind, that he brought this to all of us. And it has been passed down to us to this very day. And I don't think it was just the teaching that he brought that was passed down to us, but the person himself. When someone is trains themselves, and I'll be talking about this a little bit more, trains themselves in letting go of the self, what comes through is the light of the Dharma, the brightness of our true nature. And this can be seen in that person. And I'm sure, although I didn't live at the time of Shakyamuni Buddha, I'm sure for those people who did, they felt something there, the radiance of his being, because of his letting go. And the Buddha taught that we all have the same nature that he has. He was born as a human being and died as a human being and lived as a human being. And what he found through his search and his enlightenment is what we now call Buddha nature. And we all have this nature within us already. It's already there. And that is what brings us to training. That is what brings us to come to a Dharma talk or an introductory retreat. It's that sense of something more, something we're longing for, even if we're not aware of it. And Shakyamuni found this. And because he knew that all beings had this same nature that he had, he taught people how to find what he had found. So he wasn't someone who was just saying, here I am, this is wonderful. But he was saying, this is how you find it. You can find it for yourself. And there's a, in this book, in the Buddha's words, there's a nice section called A Handful of Leaves, which after all these years, I finally discovered. And it says, on one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Kosambi in Simsapa Grove, in a Simsapa Grove. Then the Blessed One took up a few Simsapa leaves in his hand and addressed the monks thus, what do you think, monks? Which is more numerous, these few leaves that I have taken up in my hand or those in the grove overhead? Venerable sir, the leaves that the Blessed One has taken up in his hand are few, but those in the grove overhead are numerous. So too, monks, the things I have directly known but have not taught you are numerous, while the things I have taught you are few. And why, monks, have I not taught those many things? Because they are without benefit, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life, and do not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. Therefore, I have not taught them. And what, monks, have I taught? I have taught, this is suffering. I have taught, this is the origin of suffering. I have taught, this is the cessation of suffering. I have taught, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And why, monks, have I taught this? Because this is beneficial, relevant to the fundamentals of the spiritual life, and leads to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nirvana. Therefore, I have taught this. Therefore, monks, an exertion should be made to understand this is suffering. An exertion should be made to understand this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So the Buddha understood and knew many things at the time of his enlightenment. And because he knew that, he sensed that others could find this as well, although he was hesitant to teach it first. He thought, no one will understand. But then he decided to teach and realized that there were people who would understand. And so his teaching is to point the way for us to have our own understanding. And he spent his whole life in helping others to find what he had found. So his teaching is like the finger pointing to the moon. It isn't the moon, it isn't the truth, but it's how do you find the truth? Because you can't find the truth in words. You have to find it for yourself through your own exertion. So that's why he encouraged his monks and his lay disciples who were interested to make the exertion for themselves. And the Buddha had many lay disciples who reached great depths of understanding. So the Buddha taught anyone who came to him, basically. He would talk to people singly or in groups. He was just open to anyone who was in need of help. And he taught people what was good for them to hear. For those who were interested in finding the truth, as he had found, he taught them everything. For those who couldn't go that way, he helped them how to live a good life. So he was compassionate to all beings and helped them in ways that that were good for them. So Shakyamuni Buddha, who was then Gotama or Prince Siddhartha, when he was born over 2,500 years ago, was born into a life of luxury. And I don't know how much you all know about Shakyamuni. I won't go into detail about it. But his father was King Suddhodana, and his mother was Queen Maya, and he was Prince Siddhartha. And his parents tried to shelter him from all suffering and to help him. They wanted him to be happy. And I think some parents, you know, try and do that. They want their children to be happy, so they try to, you know, shelter them from suffering. But I think in the case of the Buddha, it was to the extreme, so that he had three palaces for each season, so he wouldn't, you know, suffer any temperature difficulties, which I can understand. I don't like the cold. He was really sheltered. But he had in some of the stories of the Buddha, when he was a young boy, he had a very compassionate nature and also was very meditative. He just meditated naturally at the age of 7. And so I can't believe that he, throughout his life until he was the age of 30 when he left home, that he didn't get some sense that there's something missing here. he must have started to doubt that all the pleasures that were presented to him, he had a beautiful wife, and all the pleasures that his parents could find for him. I have to believe that at some point he began to think, is this all there is to life? And in this way, it's somehow similar to our own search, the search of the Buddha and our own search, because most of us are searching for something. We may not even be aware of it, but there's something within us that there's a question, a deep question, something that we're longing for or something that we're looking for. I mean, I don't know this for sure, but this is my guess, that within all of us there's a looking and a searching. And, you know, when we're young and maybe into old age, perhaps, depending on the person, we're looking outside ourselves. We're trying to find fulfillment, contentment, peace, security, happiness outside of ourselves. We try it in so many ways, through relationships, through work, through the intellect. We may move around a lot, travel a lot, find a new relationship, find a new job, and yet it's never enough. One of the Theravadan monks, Thai monks, Ajahn Sumedho, said in one of his books that, I think it was the age of 10, he thought for sure if he was given this certain toy that he would be happy forever. You know how that goes? You kind of think, if I only had that, and the mind does this to you, if I only had that, I know I would be happy. And so he convinced his parents to give him this toy. It was probably an ad on TV that, you know, convinced you that if you had this, you'd be happy. So he got this toy, and at the age of 10, he realized that it didn't bring him happiness. And so that's pretty good to realize at the age of 10, because usually when it doesn't bring you happiness, then another greed appears before your eyes. Oh, this will bring me happiness. And that doesn't. And maybe something does bring you happiness for a while, but it doesn't last. Or you fear that you'll lose it. So that there's no lasting happiness or security in anything outside of ourselves. And I'm sure that the Buddha must have gotten the sense of this. But it says in his story that the story of his life, that he finally went outside the palace gates and saw suffering, saw that suffering existed. He saw it in a really harsh way, because there was a lot of suffering in the city that he hadn't seen within all his palaces. He saw people who were sick, who were very sick. He saw people who were dying, people who were dead, people who were old. And he was really, my guess is he was really shaken by this, and realized that this would come to him too, that this would happen to him and those he loved. He also saw a monk, and these were called the four divine messengers, old age, disease and death, and the sight of a monk, because the monk showed him that there was another way. So he left his home because he realized that love and luxury and pleasure would not bring an end to suffering, and it would not stop him from dying and those he loved dying. So he left his home in search of the cause of suffering. And I can imagine that it was very difficult for him, having led a life of luxury, to suddenly be sleeping on the ground and eating out of garbage cans or getting whatever food was offered to him. But he kept on going because he was determined. I don't know if he was desperate. I can say that when I came here, I was desperate. But I don't know. I've never read the Buddha was desperate, but perhaps he was. You know, he needed to find the cause of suffering. But he searched in many different ways, including teachers and harsh discipline, where he nearly starved himself to death. And none of these led to what he was looking for. None of them gave him the answer to his question of what is the cause of suffering? Is there liberation from death, from suffering, from misery? So we can be grateful to him for not giving up, for continuing on. And what kept him continuing on besides this determination? Was something within himself knew that there was something more. And that's what keeps us all going. That's what keeps us coming to the monastery. In my own search for the truth, although I don't know if I would have called it that at the time, I would have given up years ago. And I've been here now 40 years. If there hadn't been something within me, if there hadn't been Buddha nature there already within me that was helping me every turn of the way. So there is something that we all know and that we all long for, even if we're not aware of it. I have a feeling if I talk about everything I wanted to talk about today, that everybody's going to be asleep pretty soon, because I'm hardly, you know, even off of page one. So I might have to pare down a bit just to keep you awake. In this book where I read what the Buddha taught, which is called the Four Noble Truths, that suffering exists, that there is a cause of suffering, that there is a cessation of suffering, and that there is the Noble Eightfold Path, which is the way to the cessation of suffering. I think most of us probably know that suffering exists in some form or another. Some people have loving parents and a good life, so they may not know suffering to the extreme. But there is suffering. Just in the uncertainty of life. Your parents may have sheltered you from things, but when you graduate college, sometimes the question arises, what do I do with my life? Where do I go from here? That's what happened to me. My life was always planned out until after college, and then suddenly I had my midlife crisis at about the age of 22. What's the purpose of life? What's the meaning of life? So suffering exists in many different forms. Just the basic things of birth, old age, disease, and death, and the uncertainty of life, the uncertainty of death. And then just all the different things that we want, that we don't get, that we get and that don't fulfill us. If you just think about it, you'll think of all the different little things that create suffering, what our mind is doing. I gave a Dharma talk, which a certain layperson will remember very clearly, in which I was afraid that that was going to happen at this Dharma talk too, but it hasn't so far. In which I hadn't prepared very well, and I was going to really trust in my Buddha nature and just come out here and see what came. you know, see what surfaced. And I came out here trusting, and nothing came. And and I sat here in silence, and nothing came. And I felt I was really scared. This was my deepest fear, that I would come out here and embarrass myself in front of everyone. And I just sat, and then I thought, well, I'm just going to have to get up and leave in this deep humiliation. And I'm joking about it now, but it wasn't a joke then. It was serious. And I won't be able to ever face anyone again. And I don't know if any of you have ever felt this way. You know, you've embarrassed yourself or you've been humiliated, and how can you ever face anyone again? And then something came through. And it was, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was something like, knowing the truth is more important than feelings. I mean, that's my interpretation of it now. I can't really remember what it was, but that there is something deeper than the feelings that arise. And we always have these feelings, different feelings and thought arise all the time that make us miserable, that create suffering. And this wonderful teaching was given to me in the midst of my suffering, that feeling humiliation wasn't important. And then I was just able to talk. And I talked about the fear, and I talked about what I had just been taught, and everything was fine. And it's interesting how in life, and I know in training, that we can just be feeling awful, and all these things can seem so important to us, and then something shifts. And it's just feeling, or it's just thought. And sometimes I'll go to bed at night feeling miserable, and in the morning it's gone. I remember once when I was in college, and I was truly suffering when I was in college, and I'd be depressed a lot. And I remember one time I woke up in the morning and I felt fine. And I thought, why do I feel fine? And it was before all the suffering came on. It was like there was this clarity, and then I let the suffering just come in, and then I felt it. And but I didn't know about Buddhism in those days, so I didn't know there was a way out of suffering. I didn't understand. So the first noble truth is that suffering exists. And the second noble truth is that there is a cause of suffering. And during the time of the Buddha's understanding, what we call his enlightenment, he didn't just make this up or just figure it out. It was something that he deeply saw into in his meditation, that this is suffering. This is the cause of suffering. This is a cessation of suffering. This is the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. And the cause of suffering is what he called clinging or craving. I'd like to add on to that the defilements, which are based on greed, anger, and delusion. All the things that kind of cloud our minds from the truth, all the things that we get pulled into and act on that lead to suffering. Wanting things, not getting what we want, being angry, being confused. And all of these stem from not knowing things as they truly are, from ignorance. The cessation of suffering is the letting go of craving, of clinging, of greed, hate, and delusion. And how do we do this? The Noble Eightfold Path, the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. The Buddha discovered this at the time of his enlightenment. And he spent the rest of his life teaching this to other beings. And it has come down to us today through the training and compassion of all the Buddhas and ancestors so that we can find it now. And it isn't an easy path. It's very difficult. One of the I don't know if it's cornerstones, I can't think of the words. What is so important to this path is our meditation. Because in meditation, we learn how to let go. We learn how to see our greed, hate, and delusion when they arise. We learn to see all the different aspects, all the different forms that they take, and we learn how to let them go. And even after 40 years, I find it difficult to let go. It's getting better, but these things are so insidious. The things that we want, you know, we really want them. And, you know, the people that annoy us, the things that we don't get that we really want. We think that anger will make us happy if, you know, we... The Buddha taught, he spent his whole life teaching us how we can let these things go and all the other aspects of the path that help us to cultivate this letting go. And it's in this letting go that we find nirvana. We find the truth. We find true peace of heart. We find our Buddha nature. And as I said, it's what we truly long for. To become one with our true nature, to know our true nature, to live from our true nature, to not create any more suffering, to find true peace of heart. And we can find this. Shakyamuni Buddha held out the sun of hope for in a world of darkness. During the recent Keeping of the Ten Precepts retreat this year, which was just in March, in our final discussion during this retreat with the lay trainees, we started talking about what are koans. And it was a very interesting discussion. And I actually found a nice description of what koans are in Roar of the Tigress. This is talks by River Master G.U. Kennett, who was my teacher, in which she talks about, you know, the Buddha, you know, going out in the search of the cause of suffering, that was the very first koan. And here is what she says in the footnote. A statement or story of the catalyst for an ancient master's enlightenment, which is used by a Zen master as a teaching device to help a disciple realize her or his true nature. By extension, it means any spiritual barrier or fundamental question in one's training, which one needs to face, penetrate, clarify, and transcend. In Rinzai Zen, formal koans are used in meditation practice. In Soto Zen, the emphasis is on the naturally arising koans of everyday life. So that, am I going on too long? You'd be too polite to say so. So in everyday life, we all have our own kind of unique koan that presents itself, and yet it's all very similar. What is it that is difficult to us that we work on in our training? Do we have trouble getting annoyed with people? Do we get jealous? Are there particular things that kind of go against the grain that disturb us? These are the things we learn to train with. Forever Master Jiyu, she trained in Japan, and her koan there was that she was a female and a foreigner in an all-male Japanese temple. And the way they treated her there was not very good. It was not very nice. Most people didn't want her there. However, she saw in her master and many of the other monks there the truth, as people at the time of Shakyamuni Buddha could see that in Shakyamuni himself. She saw in others what she longed for. She saw that brightness that I spoke of. And yet it was very difficult for her there because of her situation. And she learned how to train with that. She learned how to be at peace and still within the difficulties that life presented for her there. And we all have our own circumstances that life presents to us. And when we're training, we learn how to train within them and to make those difficulties be our teaching. And it does. It does become that. And I'll just tell you, this training works, as many can attest to. But also the deeper aspect of the koan that she brought with her to Japan, which was similar to what Shakyamuni Buddha's koan was she had was a young person during World War II in England, and she lived through the bombings that went on in England, and she knew of the cruelty that went on during that war with the Nazis. And after the war, she couldn't understand why there was all this cruelty and why death existed and why there was all this suffering. So when she went to Japan, that is the question that she brought with her. That's what she was looking for. What is the cessation of suffering? When I came to Shasta Abbey, I'm sure I didn't really know what my koan was. I was suffering deeply. A couple years ago, had graduated from college, and I wondered what was the purpose of life. Was life meaningful? And I was pretty desperate to find this answer. I was searching in all different directions, then I came to Shasta Abbey, and I saw... And also, I realized later, in looking back, that what I was searching for, one aspect of my koan was, does selfless compassion exist? Because I hadn't known this in my life. And I saw in Reverend Master Jiyu, I saw that brightness that I spoke of. And I saw in her that selfless compassion existed. Because she was deeply training and helping all around her. So I come back to the offertory of Shakyamuni brought the Son of Hope to a world of darkness. It's important to see this Son of Hope, to see this training and this brightness in another person. For Shakyamuni, he didn't have that luxury. He had to find it for himself. He was a remarkable human being, and he had to just keep on going until he could find it for himself. But we have that luxury. We can see it in other people. I could see it in Reverend Master Jiyu. She could see it in her master. You can see it in those who are training deeply. And you can see it in the teaching. There is something more than just ordinary daily life. There is something more than the suffering we feel. And yet we have to make the effort to find it. At the time of Shakyamuni, he was the only one who had found the truth. Now there are many people who have found the truth, and there is 2,500 years of many other people finding the truth. So there is kind of a sense that there is something. But at the time of Shakyamuni, they didn't know. And so he had to really help people with their faith, you know, encourage them, tell them that there was something. He had to encourage them to have faith in him, have faith in his teaching, because he was the only one. He was the only example for a while, although it seemed like everybody he talked to became enlightened right away in the beginning. So there were many examples after that. But seeing others who are training, seeing changes that take place in other people through this training, doing the practice and seeing changes that take place within yourself. This is what keeps us going. This is what helps us with our faith. But I can tell you that there is a cessation of suffering. I can't tell you that I found it, but I can tell you that there is a cessation. And that for those of you who have just come here for the first time, if you're searching for something, this is one way that you can find an answer. For those of you who have been training with us for a while, I can tell you, just keep on going. Because no matter what, just keep on going. No matter how difficult it becomes, no matter how many doubts you may have, because it isn't easy, and we go through different phases of doubts and faith and, you know, even throughout the day. But just keep on going. There's something that is helping you and that will keep you on the path. And just to read something from that was at the beginning of a book called The Island, which is a compilation of different things that the Buddha said about nirvana. And this is just a little thing at the very beginning that says, "It is the unformed, the unconditioned, the end, the truth, the other shore, the subtle, the everlasting, the invisible, the undiversified, peace, the deathless, the blessed, safety, the wonderful, the marvelous, nirvana, purity, freedom, the island, the refuge, the beyond." And in, you can't get me to stop. Just keep on going. And in what's called the Udana scripture, I'll just read this and then I will end. It says, the Udana is verses of uplift. "Thus have I heard, on a certain occasion, the Exalted One was staying near Savati in Anathapindika's park. Now on that occasion, the Exalted One was teaching, establishing, rousing, and making the monks happy with a discourse according to Dharma that was centered on nirvana. And those monks, earnestly paying attention, mentally taking it all in, were listening to Dharma with ready ears. Then the Exalted One at that time, seeing the meaning of it, gave utterance to this verse of uplift. Monks, there is a not born, a not become, a not made, a not compounded. Monks, if that unborn, not become, not made, not compounded were not, there would be apparent no escape from this here that is born, become, made, compounded. But since, monks, there is an unborn, not become, not made, not compounded, Therefore, the escape from this here that is born, become, made, compounded is apparent. So I didn't tell you everything I wanted to, but I've told you a little. And I hope it helps. Thank you.